Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
This farm bill is about those who produce, those who process, and those who consume. Oh, that would be everybody. And that's just one of many reasons why this farm bill is so important. My goal for the farm bill is pretty straightforward. This is a farm bill that we can pass in a bipartisan, bicameral way. We do it on time, and quite frankly, we make it highly effective.
Representative G.T. Thompson, Chairman, House Ag Committee.
When I think about agriculture, I define American agriculture by three words. And I saw it in play today, this week here in Texas, from forestry to cattle to commodities. And those three words for American agriculture are science, technology, and innovation.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Biden administration's WOTUS definition went into effect March 20th, 2023. But the weekend before was actually really busy in the federal court.
Mary Thomas Hart is chief counsel with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
When the Biden administration announced that it was set to finalize this rule, NCBA and a coalition of other national trade associations filed a lawsuit in the Southern District of Texas asking for a nationwide injunction of the rule. Unfortunately, the district court declined our request for a nationwide injunction, but did grant an injunction in two states, Texas and Idaho. So if you live in Texas or Idaho, you're not subject to the Biden administration's WOTUS rule. However, for producers and landowners in the other 48 states, it is yet another era of WOTUS regulation.
And then there's the Supreme Court.
We're expecting a decision from the Supreme Court sometime in the coming weeks. And that decision will be in the case Sackett versus EPA, which, like I said earlier, is the fourth time that the court has considered the definition of WOTUS. But for six of the nine justices, it's the first time that they've considered the WOTUS issue. And I think that there was some consensus really across the political spectrum of the bench that significant nexus is not a viable test that can be reliably used by either landowners or regulators. So I won't be surprised at all if the decision in the Sackett case pulls back the significant nexus test in some way. And if that happens, I would say that there's a pretty high likelihood that the Biden administration's rule doesn't survive because it relies so heavily on the significant nexus test.
So if the Supreme Court rules against EPA, then what?
If that happens, the rule goes back to the drawing board, right? So EPA takes the rule back and has to rewrite it within these new confines or new restrictions put in place by the Sackett opinion. Obviously, that's a lot of guesswork, so I don't want to look too far into the crystal ball. But, you know, I think if we get a helpful opinion from the Supreme Court, it's at least going to, you know, require EPA to think a little harder, to work a little harder on a rule that more appropriately scopes the authority of the federal government in the Clean Water Act, which I think in the long term is going to be really helpful for landowners, including farmers and ranchers.
This has been an ongoing issue for 50 years, but originally was not political. But as of late,
it's certainly become a bit of a political hot potato, right? It's kind of swung back and forth during different administrations. But at the end of the day, the way I kind of started this off, I characterize WOTUS as a line drawing exercise. It's not determining which waters are going to be protected and which features are going to be polluted. It's determining which governmental entity has the authority to effectively manage those features, right? And I think for us in rural America, we understand that landowners are in the best position to manage their land and manage their water resource. It's a tough sell the further away you get from those features. And so, we'll continue working to tell that story and ensure that, you know, regulators and members of Congress alike understand the value that farmers and ranchers contribute not only to their communities, but to their natural resources as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We, in 2018 Farm Bill, asked for first update in 50 years for the Thrifty Food Plan.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying in front of a Senate Ag Committee on USDA oversight. The chairwoman of the committee from Michigan, Debbie Stabenow.
Did that update direct you to make sure that was cost neutral, Mr. Secretary?
Madam Chair, we are following the prescription and direction of the Food and Nutrition Act of 2008, passed by Congress, which directed us, and I'll quote, by the year 2022 and at five-year intervals thereafter, the Secretary shall reevaluate and publish the market baskets of the Thrifty Food Plan based on current food prices, food composition data, consumption patterns, and dietary guidance. There was no mention in the law that directed us to do the work that we needed to do about cost neutral. It basically said you're to do this every 5 years, with 2022 being the first iteration of this, and you are to focus on market baskets that reflect current food prices, food composition data, consumption patterns, and dietary guidance.
Republican members at odds with Secretary Vilsack over this. Ranking member from Arkansas, John Bozeman.
Mr. Secretary, in regard to the no direction in the law with the Thrifty Food Program, I guess the problem with that is that the no direction law regarding it being revenue neutral, yet through the technical assistance process, which USDA is intimately involved in, CBO determined that it would be revenue neutral based on the information that USDA gave them during that administration. So I understand your argument, but I just don't think it holds water. I don't think that Secretary Perdue thought that, you know, this was going to be a revenue producer of $300 billion, nor did anybody on this committee. So, you know, those are the facts, and that's really what GAO alluded to in their report.
Senator, I, with all due respect, I don't think I necessarily am bound by what Secretary Perdue decided while he was secretary.
You're bound by what this committee wanted to do, what CBO wanted to do, and we're not bound by you finding loopholes to try and not, do things as you wish.
Not a loophole, Senator. We're basically taking a look at the law that was passed by Congress directing us to take into consideration a number of factors, and one of those factors is consumption patterns, which have changed. One of those factors is current food prices, which clearly were different than they were 45 years ago. Part of it has to do with the activity of families. Part of it has to do with the mix of what families are purchasing. And to the chairwoman's comments, you know, there was a time when it was assumed that people were spending an hour and a half preparing food from scratch, and that was a basis upon which the Thrifty Food Plan was initially created. Well, that I'm pretty sure that's not the case today.
But I agree with all of that. My point is that when you're going to spend $300 billion, you come to Congress and you say, this is a problem, you know, we need to address it. You know, let's work together to sort it out. So I'm not saying that it didn't need to be updated or necessarily that we didn't need to spend some money. But the idea that an agency can spend $300 billion without congressional direction, the last bill that was the Inflation Reduction Act was only $750 billion. So this was a massive amount of money, and it wasn't done right.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
In essence, it is a venture capital support platform that comes alongside private investors looking to deploy capital in the sorghum industry.
Talking about C-Smart, or the Collaborative Sorghum Marketing Transformation Program, Cerro Ag's John Duff.
It will provide R&D, marketing, research, promotion, support to startups or established businesses that are investing in sorghum projects, and then also in parallel maintain a network of private investors that are farmers and others in the sorghum industry and adjacent to the sorghum industry that want to invest in these startups. So it really would come alongside it. It will go hand in hand with private investors deploying capital to provide funding that facilitates use of that private capital in a way that is of good value to the sorghum farmers, bottom line.
He also talks about how outside investment is driving innovation.
We just saw a $300 million investment from a Wall Street firm into Advanta Global. Took a very large stake in that company, and they did it for a couple of reasons. One, Advanta met the rate of return that this company was looking for, and it also met some sustainability metrics that this company has. So I think we're going to see more of that. We're going to see more of that in the next 5 to 10 years than we may have ever seen before in agriculture combined. And any of that is great, right? You would never turn down any capital like that coming into agriculture. But if we could pull it in a way that would impact sorghum farmers beneficially and add value to sorghum farmers, bottom line, how much further could those dollars go? And that's really what C-Smart does. It helps that capital that's flowing into agriculture, helps it come in a way that can be positive for sorghum farmers. And ultimately, sorghum farmers hopefully would be able to participate in those investments as well by co-investing with some of those larger investors that come in.
Are there real world examples?
We have already made some strategic investments. C-Smart has already made some strategic investments, invested in marketing support for an all-female led business that is on the sorghum food side. I have also helped with networking, due diligence, other facilitation type activities with a company looking at industrial sorghum starch production. And then I've also done an investment in some due diligence for a container facility that would be focused on specialty sorghum exports. And so those are three investments. Those are three activities that C-Smart has already undertaken and moved forward with in a concrete way. Of course, these things they have a long trail, right? In a lot of cases, it's years before you really reap the benefits of those investments, or you reap the benefit of the demand that those investments create. We're a long way off in being able to talk about huge successes that that the platform has created, but we have already taken concrete steps toward ensuring that those things happen, and we're doing it, like I said, in a way that matches up promotion, research, R&D, marketing support with private investment that allows sorghum farmers and anyone in the sorghum industry to participate from an investment perspective if they so choose.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We have a map put out by Iowa Farm Bureau that 97% of the land will be regulated by EPA and the Corps of Engineers. You don't know how much anxiety that brings to farmers of Iowa.
Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley is a member of the Senate Ag Committee talking about Waters of the U.S. or WOTUS.
And we can't stand for that sort of government control over agriculture that it could imply. And you know, when you have a law in effect and bureaucrats want to move, they move. And if you don't like it, you have to fight them and spend a lot of money. So you usually can't afford that. So you end up just accepting their judgment. And that's not the way American agriculture has prospered. So the one thing that holds out, I'm going to talk about a couple of things, but one thing that is going to probably modify this is a couple of Supreme Court decisions that will come down by the end of June. And I think that's going to curtail the massive government regulation that comes from the Biden and it was also similar to the Obama WOTUS regulations. The other thing is we do have some action that Congress is going to take in the next couple weeks through what we call the Congressional Review Act, which is an opportunity for Congress to show our disapproval of this regulation, and hopefully we'll have the votes to pass it. And so I look forward to expressing my opinion on that vote on the Congressional Review Act. In other words, I will vote to disapprove of WOTUS.
But at this point, no one expects President Biden to sign this. So what's next?
Well, don't forget, a Texas judge has already, for the state of Texas and Idaho, declared it. I don't know how he made his decision, but he said that it's invalid and is holding it up in those states. And then don't forget, in the 15 and 16 year era, several courts, including at least one circuit court, put a national injunction against it. Then I think the Supreme Court case is going to make such of an impact. But my vote will show Biden's bipartisan rejection of the rule. And I think it's important that he knows that it doesn't have, you know, the support that he thinks it has. In other words, it's Congress's way of saying EPA's not following the law.
Recent Senate Ag Committee hearing where Kansas Senator Roger Marshall questioning USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack on EPA.
So in order to utilize environmentally sound practices like no-till farming, which we've been doing for over 20 years on our family farm, we have to have use of these pesticides. Otherwise, we're going to have to go back to plowing, which creates an increased carbon footprint. Do you feel like EPA is balancing this issue of carbon footprint? So they're using their practices. We're going to have to plow the ground, which we know is a huge carbon sink.
We have raised that issue with them repeatedly.
And what do they say?
They have a disagreement with us, Senator.
Okay.
I don't know.
Thank you.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
It is. I think from a multitude of perspectives, if we think about the U.S. consumer just facing higher prices across the board, no matter what they're buying, and probably larger inflation or larger price increases in the food space, those grocery budget dollars just get tighter and tighter.
Caitlin McCulloch is the director of the Livestock Marketing Information Center, and she agrees that inflation will be a driving factor for beef demand.
I guess what happens with fiscal policy and what the government decides to do in response to inflation is going to matter a lot. There's talk of either the Federal Reserve pausing their increasing interest rates, maybe they only increase a slight amount. All of those will have the impact on the consumer as well, even if they're trying to tackle, you know, the very specific problem of inflation or some of this banking sector turmoil. And so what those consumer impacts are going to be a little bit murky here for a bit. But ultimately, beef demand has been very good for several years now, and we haven't really seen a slowdown at the meat case. And so we're just wondering if this is the event that maybe starts to change that picture a little bit.
One indicator of change, according to McCulloch, is something known as boxed beef.
So boxed beef is an aggregate measure that we like to talk about it because it kind of encompasses everything. But, you know, more generally, right, the consumer probably buys ribeyes or they buy ground beef, something very specific, and maybe they change from ribeye down to ground beef if that's a little bit more in their budget. Those things can happen depending on the economic circumstance or changes in tastes and preferences. So boxed beef is this collective number we like to reference as kind of this one price for meat, if you will. And that, for choice graded beef, that's holding 283 this week, or last week, I should say. And that's been holding a very strong price for several weeks now. Now, the interesting thing that I think is that the select price is over 270 and has been over that price for a while as well. And that means that choice select spread now has narrowed to about $10 a hundred or so, down from a very high level earlier this year. So we started the year with that spread being closer to $27 a hundredweight, which is an anomaly for that time of year. Usually first quarter of the year, we're under $10 in terms of spreads between choice and select box beef.
Now, the LMIC has provided analysis and projections concerning the livestock industry since 1955. And one of those trends, cash prices typically tighten.
So last week, Dodge City popped back up after a week where five to sixes took a pretty big hit from the previous week. So 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were at 212 to 200 per hundredweight, then dropped back down to 188 the week before. And then last week, we popped back up to over 220 for 5 to 550 weights. And so some strong prices in there, and I would expect those to get a little better and better as your grass shows up and improves, but may take a hit if the opposite is true. Just depends on rain in this time of year and what's out there for forage abilities. Now, I mentioned the five area price was at 165. That's been a very steady and strong price, and I would expect that to kind of hold together maybe through April or so, but we should start to see, we may start to see that come down a little bit depending on what shakes out with both the demand situation. And typically that third quarter is one of the lower quarters of the year. However, given what I think is going to happen with cattle on feed inventory, I wouldn't be surprised to see a very strong third quarter this year in terms of prices.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Let me talk about the meat and poultry processing as an example.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack recently testifying before the Senate Ag Committee as part of a USDA oversight hearing, talking about investments in rural areas.
In addition to providing nearly 3,000 facilities assistance and help on inspection fees, we've also helped nearly 277 facilities expand market opportunities by allowing them to be able to sell across state lines, expanding their markets. We've announced 31 projects already where we're providing grant money to expand or to build new processing capacity. That's going to strengthen local and regional food systems. We are not finished. We have more work to do. You'll see more announcements over the next several months of additional projects that we're funding. You'll see a second round of resources being made available. And you'll also see a round of resources being made available for non-meat and poultry processing opportunities. So you're going to see a significant investment that we can make in strengthening the processing capacity, which creates additional markets. And this is important, particularly for small and mid-sized producers, because it creates the opportunity for them to negotiate, to have a different market opportunity, to be in a situation where there's competition for whatever it is they're growing and raising. Unfortunately, in too many parts of the country today, there's just a single market, and you've got to take the price of whatever it is on that particular day.
When it comes to rural investments, Senator Dick Durbin from Illinois.
As of October, maybe September of last year, my wife and I became electric power generators in the city of Springfield, Illinois, by installing solar panels on our roof of our home. We're not the first in the city to do it, but the first in our neighborhood for sure. The net impact is that our electric bill has gone down from $115 a month to $15 a month. And that's good news for us, and I think it shows that the investment was worthwhile. So I started asking the question of farmers who visited whether they were looking into this concept of net metering. And I can recall one farmer said to me that he wanted to install a major solar panel array on his 3,000-head hog operation and benefit from net metering because he ran fans 24/7 for the livestock. He ran into a problem. It turned out the electric co-op did not have transmission lines sufficient to deal with net metering. And so we're still trying to help him, and there may be a way out. But the problem is if we have to deal with each farmer connecting up to the proper transmission arrangement, it becomes prohibitive. Now, you mentioned the REAP program. The REAP program is very good, but it deals with the farmer on the farm, and it doesn't deal with distribution lines, as I understand it. Is that your understanding, too?
That's correct, but there's another part of the Inflation Reduction Act that does potentially respond to your concern, which is the effort to help RECs decarbonize their generation capacity. And so we have a significant opportunity that can leverage resources under the Inflation Reduction Act to encourage RECs to convert from fossil fuel-based generation systems to renewable systems, which in turn would result in the need for the infrastructure necessary to make that happen.
Are you aware of any electric co-ops in rural areas that are pursuing this?
We're just beginning that process because of the passage of the law. I think you will see and hear more about that this year, later this year, as we begin the process of reaching out to RECs and making a request for application and see what kind of interest there may be.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
How might various commodity producers fare financially during the coverage period of a new farm bill? Texas A&M Extension economist Joe Outlaw said at Monday's AgriPulse Ag and Food Policy Summit that based on sample research, projections indicate...
For the first time in a long time, our outlook is very strong for the feed grains, and I would say this is the best wheat outlook we've ever had in 40 years. The set of farms that are not as good are cotton farms, about half of them look to be in good shape, and only about a fourth of our rice farms. And on the livestock side, it's 50-50 in terms of the producers that look like they're going to fare this time during the farm bill process and come out the other end in good shape.
Outlaw acknowledges that events during the life of a new farm bill could cause reduced commodity prices. But as for the why for the outlook for financial shape for producers at the start of a new farm bill,
it's because they've accumulated a lot of cash either through the ad hoc payments
as well as current prices received for their commodities. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.